You've probably heard about the job of an intimacy coordinator. But do you know what they actually do?
And every intimacy coordinator's kit is going to be some form of mint.
Really?
I think most of the time.
Wait.
Oh, 100%.
Huh.
Then we add in the full retro Listerine breath strip, which is crucial.
Several years into the era of the intimacy coordinator, we ask what they've changed for the better in Hollywood and what still needs work. This week on Into It, Vulture's Pop Culture Podcast.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
Charlie, I have some Billboard chart trivia for you. You ready?
Okay, yeah.
Here's the question. Who was the oldest artist to ever hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100? Okay, I'm talking about the oldest artist when they recorded the song and that song then went to number one. Who is that?
Ooh, I'm first of all interested in what even that age range is. I'm guessing it's in the 50s to 60s range, potentially.
I'll give you a hint. The second oldest artist is Cher with her song Believe.
Ooh, yeah.
She was 53 when that was recorded.
Right, right. Okay.
So the number one oldest artist is going to be older than that.
Okay. I'm going to throw out Frank Sinatra.
That's a great guess, and you're warm,
ooh, okay.
But that's not quite right. This artist hit number one in 1964, knocking the Beatles off the charts, okay? The young hot group of the 60s. And they did it with this song.
Okay, we got some banjo. No, you're a banjo player.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis Dolly.
Louis Armstrong.
Yes, you got it immediately, Charlie. Louis Armstrong. But I have to correct you, okay? Not Louis. Common misperception.
Really? Oh.
Yes. You hear him say it at the very beginning of the song, actually. He prefers his name to be pronounced Louis.
This is Louis Dolly.
Oh, I'm an idiot.
You're not alone. Everyone calls him Louis Armstrong, except Louis Armstrong, who called himself Louis. So that's our first lesson of this episode.
Yeah. Setting the record. Okay, and how old was he?
He was 62 years young.
Oh, this is great. So I still have nearly 25 years to get a number one hit on the Hot 100. This is good to know. Okay.
Yeah, no, the window has not closed.
Great.
Okay, so this is kind of a cool anniversary, I think. It's been 60 years since Armstrong recorded this number one hit, Hello, Dolly. And it's 100 years since Armstrong made his first ever recordings. That was back in 1923.
Wow.
So I thought the centennial year might be the perfect time to talk about the sound and the legacy of this artist who has shaped the sound of popular music in profound ways.
This is a nice little detour to go down. I like this. Okay, tell me about Louis Armstrong.
First of all, great pronunciation. Love to hear
Thank
that.
Thank you. I'm working on it.
And secondly, I don't know what your perception of Armstrong is. I could talk about my own prior to researching and learning more about him. I thought of him as kind of a comic figure, kind of larger than life, someone to impersonate, someone whose songs like What a Wonderful World are popular, but almost so commonplace that they've kind of lost some of their edge, I think.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Yeah, definitely that. Nearly cliche.
What I've since learned about Armstrong repudiates that reputation. He was, in fact, a radical figure, someone who recreated the very formula of popular music. And someone who every single pop singer in 2023 is indebted to, whether they know it or not.
You're going to have to tie some threads together for me to get from 1923 to 2023.
Well, then let's start unspooling those threads at the very beginning of Armstrong's career.
Okay.
What I propose we do is spend the first half of the episode tracking Armstrong's career and hearing how he developed his iconic sound. And in the second half, consider how this sound shaped every popular musician who followed him.
Okay.
My bold claim, as you say.
Yeah, yeah.
And to do that, I think we have to go back to the very beginning. We have to go to New Orleans, where Armstrong was born in 1901 and where he learned to play the cornet, a type of trumpet, when he was sent at the age of 12 to the Colored Waifs Home for Boys. By the time he was 17, Armstrong had become one of the most sought-after trumpet players in the city, playing on riverboats up and down the Mississippi River. And his talent took him from New Orleans up to Chicago and then to New York City in 1924, where he recorded this solo on the song Sugarfoot Stomp.
Great evidence for why everybody wants to be the trumpeter. You get to lead the whole orchestra.
Totally. The trumpet was the definitive instrument of jazz in the 1920s when this recording was made. Like, if you thought of hot music, you thought of the trumpet. And that had a lot to do with Armstrong himself. When you listen to this recording, you're hearing so many hallmarks of New Orleans jazz. It's bluesy. It's got this rhythmic drive. But it has something else that was special about Armstrong. The solo really tells a story.
It has a vocal quality.
Now, Armstrong didn't come up with this himself. He actually modeled his sound after his first mentor, the legendary New Orleans trumpeter, Joe King Oliver. And I'll illustrate this for you, Charlie. Okay. Because that solo we just heard from Louis Armstrong,
yeah.
Here's how it starts. And here's a solo from his mentor, King Oliver.
Huh. Right. It has that same opening, long, bendy note. Wah, wah,
wah, wah, wah, wah.
Repeat it and then kind of go. And it makes you realize that obviously jazz is an improvised form, but it leans on a bunch of established licks and melodies and things that you've practiced and memorized.
We're hearing Armstrong playing New Orleans jazz. I mean, literally, he's like playing his mentor's solo note for note.
Yeah.
But that's not why we're interested in Armstrong, ultimately. It's because how he takes that musical language and develops it. You can hear this when he moves to New York City. In 1924, he gets hired by the biggest band in town, the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra. And when he arrives, these sophisticated New York musicians look at him a little askance. They're like, who's this country boy coming into our high-toned New York City orchestra? And he doesn't make the best impression. In fact, shortly after his arrival, the band is reading a chart and they get to a section marked PP for volume. So that means like pianissimo, like very quiet, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when they get to that section, the whole band gets really quiet, except Armstrong, who just blares his trumpet and plays it as loud as he can. And Henderson, the leader, stops. Whoa, 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 stop. What's going on? Don't you know how to read music? And Armstrong goes, yeah, yeah, I know how to read music. PP. That stands for pound plenty. Which was his way of saying, you know, play as loud as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, this kid. But it turned out that Armstrong would become the most influential member of that band. And he would change the way the whole orchestra played because he brought this bluesy, driving New Orleans sound to the group. So Armstrong takes the New York music scene by storm. But it's what happens next that really cements his stardom, makes him the biggest jazz artist and arguably the biggest pop artist of the 1920s.
Okay.
In 1925, he leaves New York for Chicago.
Ooh.
And in Chicago, he leads his own band for the first time. And he does so with the assistance of his second wife, an outstanding musician in her own right, someone named Lil Hardin. Armstrong and Hardin start a group called the Hot Five and make a series of recordings in the 1920s that flip the script of what jazz and pop music might sound like. Let's listen to Armstrong's solo on the song Potato Head Blues to hear him develop a new melodic language.
Wow, I'm not a jazz scholar like yourself, but this feels like almost proto-bebop, where it's become much more syncopated, it's much more staccato, we're jumping all around these scales, it's swirling all around your head, it doesn't have these long kind of bends, it's just like, you don't know what's going to happen.
No, I love that analysis, Charlie. And this is probably one of the most famous solos in jazz history, because I think it takes that bluesiness and that rhythmic drive that we heard him bring from his upbringing in New Orleans, and it gives it that sort of rhythmic and harmonic sophistication that you were just talking about. This solo and others that he recorded in the mid-1920s set a new template for jazz musicians. They impelled them to tell a story the same way Armstrong does, and they raised Armstrong to the level of something like a god in music.
The playing is getting virtuosic here, it feels.
There's a technical proficiency that comes out in a recording like West End Blues from 1928, which begins with an unaccompanied Armstrong trumpet cadenza. I mean, if you were listening to that on your Victrola in 1928, you would have just been blown away. That was unlike anything you'd ever heard coming out of a 78 RPM shellac record before. And it wasn't just his trumpet playing, Charlie, though that was impressive. He actually brags about it a little bit on a recording called Big Butter and Egg Man.
Great titles.
Oh, I'll play you a little minor in G. And if you say it's necessary, baby, why I'll even hit high C.
Did a big personality.
I love that. He sings, if it's necessary, I'll even hit high C. That's both a kind of romantic or quasi-sexual gesture. and it's a little bit of bragging. Like, I'm so good at the trumpet, I can reach these notes that no one else can.
Right. That's so funny.
But this recording also tunes us into another key aspect of Armstrong's sound, which is he's not just a trumpeter, he's a vocalist well. And during this period in Chicago, he also records his first vocal tracks, including one where he introduces a style that would become incredibly influential called scat singing.
Huh.
What's scat singing, Charlie?
Something I can't do. Something I should never do. We'll never do again. I'm sorry.
I know. And that was me. I only asked you that because I knew you would produce something
deeply embarrassing.
As embarrassing as that. So thank you for rising to the occasion.
You're welcome. It's an earned skill is what it is that I do not have.
Armstrong created his own legend around the development of scat singing. He said he was recording a song called Heebie Jeebies and he dropped the lyric sheet on the floor and he had to scramble to make up these nonsense syllables on the spot. That's probably not true, but nonetheless, the result was undeniable.
His scat singing is kind of like the hybrid between his actual singing and his trumpet playing. You get the two of them, you get him doing the scat thing, though I doubt he's going to hit a high C on that voice, just on the trumpet.
No high C's, but I like your analysis, Chuck. It does retain the same rhythmic drive and bluesiness of his trumpet playing, but now it's got this added dimension of the beep, bop, boop, bop. And that's still like, certainly every jazz singer sings scat to some degree.
Yeah.
But this is something you hear constantly in pop music as well.
What? Scat singing? I mean, since the Scat Man?
I'm a scat man!
Charlie, do I need to remind you of Robert Plant's scatting at the end of Led Zeppelin's What Is and What Never Should Be?
I hadn't thought of it. Not bad. Not bad. Okay. I didn't realize that scat singing extended into the world of 60s and 70s rock. I'll be curious if we can draw a more contemporary connection, but maybe the place that we hear scat singing and popular music is more like the vocal ad libs that happen in the final chorus, the places of over the top musical expression that feel maybe tied both to scat singing as well as sort of the spontaneous improvisation of musical call outs in a gospel choir.
Okay, how about Harry Styles with music for a sushi restaurant?
No.
Excuse me, green tea, music for a sushi restaurant. Fall eyes, all eyes.
Okay, you've proven your point.
Scooby dooby doo boo bow.
Scat is still alive.
For Armstrong's wife and collaborator, Lil Hardin, this moment in Heebie-Jeebies when Armstrong started scatting was so effective because it represented his effervescent, spontaneous personality.
Louis was always so full of fun, you never knew what he was going to do. Because he had a way of saying funny things. He had 2-3 words that he had made up himself, and he used to say, two of them was boninibable and prohibisonurity. So I doubt if he dropped the music. He just felt like not saying the real words, just saying something else. That's really what I think happened.
That was an interview from much later in her life, but I love how she shines light on Armstrong's personality, you know, making up words, prohibitinuity. he clearly just had this such an active mind and such a creative spirit. And you can hear that when he scats.
Yeah.
From the release of Heebie-Jeebies in 1926, Armstrong's arc just continues to ascend. He moves back to New York, but this time he's not part of any orchestra. He's a solo star in his own right, and he's the featured soloist in a Broadway show called Hot Chocolates, which opened in 1929 and had as its centerpiece Armstrong's performance of the song Ain't Misbehavin'. Throwing in a little quotation of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue during that trumpet solo.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
This is a musician at the top of his game, but he's not just singing pop hits. He's singing some songs that have a more trenchant message, a message about the frayed state of race relations in Jim Crow America. Songs like Black and Blue, which are not the kind of fluffy pop songs that we've heard from him so far, but cut right to the core of his experience as a black man in America.
I'm white inside, but that don't help my case. Cause I can't hide what is in my bed.
I'm white inside, but that don't help my case. I can't hide what's in my face. You don't encounter a lot of songs in the 1920s with that kind of direct confrontation of racial identity.
How will it end? Ain't got a friend. My only sin is in my skin. What did I do to be so black and blue?
From the heights of Broadway showbiz in New York, Where's left to go, Charlie? He's conquered New Orleans, Chicago, New York. Where are you going to go next at this point?
Hollywood. Movies.
Hollywood. Exactly. He moves out to Hollywood, California. He stars in movies. He forms his own orchestra for the first time. And he really cements his case for being the star performer of this generation. Remember earlier we heard him bragging about hitting high C's on his trumpet?
Yeah.
Check out what he does in the 1930s in his recording of Swing That Music. I want to count the high C's that he hits at the end of this song.
Great. Okay.
Okay, here we go, Chuck. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41.
Oh, and he goes up.
And then he ends with a high F. So 41, actually 42, because I didn't count the very first one. 42 high C's at the end of that recording. That is someone who has complete command and control of his instrument, who knows how to excite an audience, and who is being celebrated for being the most visionary trumpeter and vocalist of the 20s and 30s.
He's flexing.
It is a flex, as the kids would say.
Hello, fellow kids.
And from here, Armstrong soars. Right, he's conquered all the major cities in the U.S., and now he starts touring the world. He actually becomes an ambassador for the U.S. State Department, one of the few artists to pierce the Iron Curtain later in the 1950s. He travels to Africa and performs in Zimbabwe. He travels to Egypt and performs in front of the pyramids. This is a global superstar, someone who has come a long way from his roots in the colored waifs home for boys in New Orleans, where he first learned how to play the trumpet. Pretty incredible story.
Globetrotting trumpeter, singer, scatter, movie star, Broadway.
Knocking the Beatles off the charts in 1964. All right. But Charlie, I promise you even more, right? I promise you someone who had changed the sound of popular music forever. Let's see if I can back that up when we come back after a quick break.
More than just scatting. Promise?
Pinky swear.
Unexplainable's got a new two-part series we're calling The Black Box. It's all about the mysterious hole at the center of modern artificial intelligence.
I've built these models. I've studied these models. We just don't understand what's going on here.
Even the experts don't really know how these systems work or what they can do.
If we open up ChatGPT or a system like it, you just see millions of numbers flipping around and we just have no idea what any of it means.
We are rushing at breakneck speed towards more and more advanced forms of AI.
You know, when I see something that is well beyond my understanding, I'm scared. And that was something well beyond my understanding.
I'm Noam Hassenfeld, but this isn't my voice. And it hasn't been the whole time. It's just an AI I made that sounds sort of like me. And Unexplainable's new series starts July 12th, wherever you get your podcast.
Charles, I think what makes Armstrong so important in the history of pop music is the quality that his collaborator, Lil Hardin, talked about in that audio clip I played in the first half. The sense that you are hearing his personality on record whenever you listen to him, that you're not just hearing someone who is performing the notes on the page,
right,
but you're hearing someone who is bringing their voice, their interpretation, their individuality to a song. That's something we might take as a given now in pop music, but it wasn't always the case. Armstrong broke that mold and created that template.
I instantly, of course, recognized his voice when I heard it. But he's one of those instrumentalists that you can quickly point out, oh, that's Louis Armstrong playing the trumpet. And that's, you know, as a guitar player, like that's the thing every guitar player is going for. Like within three notes, you know exactly who you're hearing. And he does that.
I want to illustrate this quality by comparing two recordings of the same song.
Okay.
The first is by iconic American singer Bing Crosby. Here's his recording of the song Dinah from 1932. And when we listen to this, Charles, I want you to focus on how eloquently and perfectly Bing enunciates each of the words of this song.
Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, and you know her, over to me.
Now, here's Armstrong's recording of the same song made 1 year later in 1933. Charlie, how many of the words does Armstrong capture in his performance?
Oh, Dinah. Anyone find a little girl for life? As in, you know, or show to me.
Not convinced he hasn't completely forgotten the words, but from the get-go, the way that he says Dinah, it's unmistakable.
This is fascinating to me because you listen to the second stanza of this song. Armstrong only sings one word, basically, Dinah Lee. Yeah. He just goes, Dinah Lee. And I imagine for some people, you know, they're buying this record and they're like, wait, what? Like, what is happening here? I paid for this song and I'm only getting like, you know, a quarter of the lyrics.
Fragments. Yeah, yeah.
But that's exactly what Armstrong's appeal was. You didn't pick up an Armstrong record to get that perfect Bing Crosby delivery of the song. You picked up a record to hear Armstrong's version. Mm. And Charlie, you speculated, you know, maybe Armstrong kind of forgot the lyrics at this point. Let me play you a recording from 1930 called I'm a Ding Dong Daddy from Dumas. Great title, incidentally. And check out what happens.
I'm a ding dong daddy from Dumas, and ought to see me do me stuff. I'm clean cut fella from corners, oh, you ought to see me stuff. Oh, Jesus, I was a fool, and I done forgot the words. You know, ding dong daddy from Dumas.
Isn't there that apocryphal story of Miles Davis telling Herbie Hancock that there's no mistakes, there's just an opportunity to improvise?
That's not an apocryphal story. That's an absolutely true story. That you just related.
Okay.
And we hear that in this. He literally says, I'm a ding-dong daddy from Dumas, and I done forgot the words.
He did it with style.
And again, this is so fascinating to me because this totally defies all the logic of popular music, where, again, you're supposed to, if you're buying an album, you're expecting to hear a song you know.
Mm-hmm.
And here he's like doing the opposite. Say, oh, I don't even know the words. Sorry. And not only do people not care, they're eating it up, because what's less important is the integrity of the song than the integrity of Armstrong's performance and him being true to himself and him communicating his spontaneity and his personality.
Right. I feel like there's such a trope of contemporary records where they'll fly in some random laughter that happened to be recorded in the studio and drop it in the track to make it feel like it's not as polished as it really is.
They're trying to recreate that intimacy. Yeah. And that desire, I think you can trace back to these Armstrong records from the 20s and 30s because they crack this new code of pop music where it's not about a perfect, flawless performance. It's about the performance with the most emotion and the most direct honesty. And that's what pop singers today are striving for.
And certainly the performance of identity, that this is about Louis Armstrong and how he does it. And that's what pop stars do today as well. It's all about buying into their persona.
Okay, interesting. So you're saying you're not just buying a record now to hear someone interpret a song. You're hearing them bring their own perspective to it, right? Their unique take that they can offer.
Well, isn't this one of those Pandora's box of pop music where we all know and acknowledge that there's producers and songwriters and suits behind every big song, and yet we want to believe it is just the raw unbridled emotion of the singer and their performance, and that actually they're doing it right on the spot and that's exactly how they're feeling and they're writing it extemporaneously.
Right.
That tension that's always there.
Which brings us back to that moment Armstrong recording Heebie Jeebies, and he says, oh, I dropped the lyrics and I had to make up these scat syllables on the spot. We know that's not true, but maybe we want to believe it because
exactly.
It creates that extra layer of authenticity.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's my case, Charlie, for how Louis Armstrong invented the modern pop star as we know it. But maybe I can offer some more evidence, and we can do that by listening to one final song and reflect on its incredible longevity. It's What a Wonderful World, recorded in 1967.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Even if Armstrong hadn't made all these revolutions that we've just been talking about, I feel like this song alone would earn him a place in the pop pantheon. It has been used in so many films, commercials, It's what I sing to my son before bed.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And it's been reworked by a surprising number of artists. Check out Joey Ramone's version of What a Wonderful World.
I see the blue.
The world is wonderful, and it contains multitudes, including any kind of cover you could possibly imagine of What a Wonderful World.
Even Ghostface Killa has taken a stab at this classic.
I see the blunts for me and you, and I say to myself, what a
Okay, so there's Ghostface Killa and Raekwon turning this Armstrong classic into an ode to cannabis. But the version of the song I Want to End With Charlie is from 2019, 52 years after the original recording. It's by John Batiste, a pianist and singer who, like Armstrong, hails from New Orleans. And his performance of What a Wonderful World brings out a certain darkness that might be latent in this song that a lot of other performers don't really try to capture.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And I think in doing so, he's really paying homage to Armstrong himself, this multidimensional performer who had so many aspects to his playing and to his career, and whose music continues to resonate for artists and listeners 100 years after he first put his sound on record.
This is illuminating for me. I feel like next time I hear really any pop song, especially all of the ad-libs at the end, I'm going to be thinking Louis Armstrong and his legacy.
Switched On Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz. Brandon McFarland is our engineer. Art Chung edits the show. Abby Barr does community management. Iris Gottlieb creates our incredible illustrations. And Nisha Kerwa is our executive producer. We're a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Tell us your favorite Louis Armstrong song at Switched On Pop on Instagram and Twitter. We'll be back next Tuesday with a brand new episode. And until then,
thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.